Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm Matt Goldberg, the site's managing editor, and with me today are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And Dave Trumbore.
Welcome.
Today we will be talking about summer 2013. By the movie-going calendar, summer begins the first week of May and ends on Labor Day weekend. This has been an interesting summer, in the sense that, like all summers, good movies, bad movies, but there's always a perception that this is the worst year ever, and we lean towards the negative. I was actually at a panel yesterday at Dragon Con where it was literally about, it was called Movies We Hate, and I accidentally got on the panel itself. I just wandered in to watch, and that was a fun story. But the panel itself, the content of it, is people were piping up. It's like, I didn't like this about this movie. And they were talking about Man of Steel and Star Trek Into Darkness and those movies. And we look at our data in terms of Rotten Tomatoes and Box Office Mojo, and we see successes and the sort of the problem of critical success and box office success rarely. They occasionally overlap, but not enough. And Matt Singer over at The Dissolve did a good thing where he tried to compile Rotten Tomato scores with summer grosses and came up with sort of the sense that this was not as bad a year as compared to other years, and yet why are we so disappointed with summer 2013, and I'll get to, I think he makes some good points, but before we get to what he said, Adam and Dave, what are your feelings about summer 2013?
Go ahead, Adam.
I thought it wasn't bad. I mean, compared to previous years, I thought this was actually a pretty good summer. We were talking before the podcast, there really wasn't one big standout movie, but there were plenty of, you know, surprises. I was pleasantly surprised by The Wolverine, and I liked World War Z quite a bit. I mean, neither of those movies are great or something that's going to, you know, stand the test of time, but it's certainly better than, you know, like last year where it was just, you know, like Snow White and the Huntsman, Prometheus, Men in Black 3, just a bunch of kind of really subpar movies that kind of left a bad taste in the mouth. So for me, summer 2013 was fairly successful. I had a good time, and I mean, there were stinkers in there, but I felt like it was a worthwhile summer as far as movies go.
For me, coming into the year, like earlier this year when we talked about movies we were anticipated of seeing, I was happy with just the sheer number of sci-fi movies that were going to be coming out. Those expectations were quickly dashed once the movies themselves actually were released, because a lot of them were just kind of derivative and boring somehow. I don't know how you make it boring. But they managed, so I was a little disappointed with that. The superhero movies, again, I think the expectations were a little higher than the payoff. They certainly gave us a lot to talk about throughout the year and will give us more to talk about in years to come when those inevitable sequels pop up again. But I'm a little underwhelmed looking back at the summer. There's nothing, with the exception of one or two movies, there's nothing that really stands out that, if it were to be re-released, which we can talk about in a little bit too, I don't know if I'd actually go and take advantage of that, again, with the exception of one or two. So it's been a little underwhelming for me. I can point to a lot that I was really excited to see, and then they just didn't quite meet my expectations. That being said, I think I'm in the minority with the rest of the world and the country, because we talked about this offline. The numbers are pointing to one of the biggest, at least the financial numbers are pointing to one of the biggest summers on record, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I believe this was incredibly successful box office wise, but we also have to take 3D into account.
Sure.
And where are people spending their entertainment dollar? And I don't know if the biggest, I guess the biggest summer ever, is that just for the U.S.? I'm not sure yet.
See, that I don't know.
See, that's the other concern. For instance, a film like Pacific Rim just barely crossed 100 million here, yeah, and it made 400 million worldwide.
See, that's one of the ones that I wouldn't have minded them doing a re-release over, like, maybe not over Labor Day weekend, since other people kind of beat them to the punch, but I would have been okay with a re-release.
I would have liked to see that on IMAX again.
Yeah,
I think
yeah,
that would have been a good idea, but studios book up those IMAX theaters really quickly. They're pretty,
yeah, there's only a
pretty much solid for a year. So.
Right. Unfortunate.
Well, for me, the summer, and this is just me being a snooty critic, is I think we got a lot of good indie films in the summer, and yeah. I hope people go see them. But I know when we talk summer 2013, and we're talking about the blockbusters. And I have to agree, I would say that 2012 didn't really blow me away either, but it had the Avengers.
Right.
And from the word go...
Yeah, but that was
go,
basically it.
But that's what I'm saying.
But
from the word go, it carried through, and everyone was like, there was something to be energized about. And while Iron Man 3 is still the highest grossing film of the year, and it's a fun movie, and I'm going to get it when it comes out on Blu-ray,
right.
It didn't leave an impact. And I would say, but there were like big summer movies I enjoyed. I liked Monsters University a lot, and what surprises me is that it was walloped by Despicable Me 2. I never would have thought that Despicable Me 2 would have done so incredibly well, because it's not like it got incredibly great reviews. The first movie,
it's those Minions, man.
That, I know, right? And that's it's the Minions, and it there's a move. The spinoff comes out next December, and I have to watch that. Like, how much money can that freaking thing make now that they're just skipping to what people want?
It's Universal's Golden Goose. It's at $822 million worldwide now.
Save.
And which is great because the Minions don't speak any language. They're adorable wherever you go. So, yeah, Despicable Me 2, I would say, if there was a big surprise hit of the summer other than... I would say Despicable Me 2 was a hit based on expectations.
Sure.
I would say the big... unexpected hit would be The Conjuring in terms of...
Now You See Me.
Oh, Now You See Me was also...
Yeah,
now
You See
Me
was a weird one. The Conjuring at least had some good positive
buzz. It had
buzz
some positive buzz. I would say...
Yeah.
I was going to finish in terms of what it cost to make. The Conjuring cost like $30 million to make and has already crossed $133 million.
But is that really a surprise anymore? I mean, we've seen that with a bunch of these sort of low budget, usually with the horror movies.
It depends. I think it depends. But I mean, that's fine. A lot of people liked it. But again, for me, I liked Monsters University. I liked The Heat a lot. I'm glad that was a success. Mm-hmm. Even though it wasn't a success, I still enjoyed White House Down. So there are films I enjoy, but I can understand where people are coming from instead of... I think it's hyperbole. What was maybe perhaps a ho-hum summer is now like, this is the worst. This is just so bad. Yeah. Yeah. So people overreact, and yet they're so quick to forget. Fast and Furious 6 was a lot of fun, and it's kind of strange that the big debate over Fast and Furious 6 is, do people like it more than Fast 5? Like, that's the back and forth of it, and yet it's still an entertaining film. So, again, I think... But it was way back in May, and who can remember that long?
I completely forgot The Hangover Part 3 came out this year.
Yeah, most people did, I think.
I think Universal almost forgot it came out this year, and then they're like, oh, shit, we got to market this.
Yeah.
So it's summer 2013 is just – it's one of those things. It's in the books, and, you know, we go into all these expectations. Like, oh, I hope this one's good. I hope this one's good. And, I mean, expectations also get inflated because all these movies are being marketed like crazy. I mean, we were – I'm already thinking about, like, the TV spot for Iron Man 3 during the Super Bowl with the plane, the people falling out of it. It's like, oh, my God. It's just these.
Or the same one for Fast and the Furious where the yet another plane shot a car out of it.
They show the third act climactic action sequence over and over and over again on those TV spots. That annoyed me.
Yeah. Right. And so the marketing, I think, it's designed to create leverage. You pump in so much money so that you get more back, but it also creates much bigger expectations.
Right.
And that just gets amplified. And those expectations are already huge when you have something like Man of Steel. You couldn't, even if you did very little marketing for Man of Steel, you'd still have people like, it's the new Superman movie and all that carries with it. It's a completely new thing and people feel very attached to Superman. So I think because expectations are being raised both by the property and by marketing, that in some cases, is it almost unfair to say like, meets expectations when these expectations could be unrealistically high?
I don't know. I think it's even hard to measure what – it's such a personal thing, like what your expectations are. You can have expectations from a marketing standpoint. Yeah, like if we invest X number of dollars, we should get Y number of dollars in return. But as far as – I don't know. I don't even know what you can expect from seeing, like Adam said, all these kind of like spoilery TV spots and trailers and clips and images and even the interviews to an extent. It's like – at one point, I don't expect anything more because I already know 60% of the movie. So it sort of takes – I'd like to have a higher level of expectation going into it just on a personal note rather than being fed all this information about what's actually going to happen in the movie. Because then when I get in there, you know, by the time I've been worn down over the last few months of getting to the movie, then my enthusiasm's less for it. So if the movie itself isn't that much stronger, and if they don't have a lot of surprises that are like waiting beyond what they revealed in the trailers and the TV spots, then I'm less inclined to be like that much more positive about it. Does that make any sense? It's sort of like I can be excited for something without knowing everything about it, and then it kind of ruins it once I get in there.
Sure, and I would say that the problem is that studios only have this way to do a marketing blitz because right. There's so much advertising, period. There's so much competing for people's attention, and it's all about the first weekend. As long as you get into the right. first weekend, nothing else matters. There's no room for a film to build buzz, so you have to keep pushing it nonstop, and that's what it creates. It creates a bubble. Every film is a bubble.
Well, traditionally, it's been about the first weekend, and then, you know, people always talk like, oh, this film has legs if it's got, you know, a top three placing the next week or two in a row. However, and we can talk about this now or in a little bit if you want, there's this weird kind of re-release virus that's going around. It seems like every studio is kind of, like, being infected by it. It's like, well, we didn't get to our target when we released back in May or June or July, so let's re-release in August and September. And it's not, you know, just a couple indie films here and there. It's some major films that I guess they just didn't hit their targets and want to see if they can squeeze a few more dollars out of people.
Well, the point of it is what happens is Paramount re-released both World War Z and Star Trek Into Darkness. World right. War Z was trying to hit, I believe, 300 million. Was that the number? 300 or 200 million?
I thought it was 200.
200, yeah.
200 million. And if it hits that benchmark, it stands to make a ton of money in the TV rights. And that's why Paramount was doing it. No matter, even if they lost money by re-releasing it in theaters, they can sell it for much more money for this TV rights for that movie. And I assume they tried to do the same thing with Star Trek, but that was a lot further away from its benchmark. I think it was like 8 million or 10, 8 or 9
I mean, it already
million.
Made 228 million, so I don't know how much. Was it trying to get to 250 or I guess
think,
it's all kind of arbitrary.
Were they trying to get up to the original? Because wasn't the original still technically, didn't it still technically have a bit more in the box office?
I think Star Trek Into Darkness did better business than
did
the
it out-earn?
Star Trek.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then Star Trek Into like Darkness did better business because Star Trek in 2009 made $257 million, and Star Trek Into Darkness made $228 million. So,
yeah,
didn't,
so.
Well, it's all about worldwide.
Well, I know I did. I'm flipping between Box Office Mojo as quickly as I can, Adam. Damn it, man.
But yeah, it's not just those the big blockbuster movies either that are sort of getting like a second shot at summer. It's interesting. It's almost like they open summer and they expect to have legs throughout it, and then if they don't hit their marks, now they have this re-release thing. You can see it with James Wan's Insidious Chapter 2 is also coming out, but this isn't so much a re-release as just like a marketing thing. They're doing the first chapter of Insidious, so the original Insidious, leading into that, and it was just announced, I think a couple of days ago, that This Is the End, which opened back in May, I believe.
June.
In June, okay, is also going to come back out again for like the first weekend in September, the first full weekend in September, I think. So this coming.
That's another. That one's at 96 million domestic. So if they can get those 4 more million, they.
Yeah. Yeah. Which that one is one of my favorites of the year so far.
Same here.
So, I mean, I'm fine with the re-release for that. It's just kind of weird. It's just they just kind of pop up and get like two releases in a summer. So it's just kind of strange, especially when, like we talked about, this is one of the biggest years on record. You would feel like they didn't necessarily have to do that. But that comes down to the distribution of which films earned the most. You know, was it a couple of films that earned crazy amounts of money and skewed the results so that it becomes the biggest box office on record? Or were there a lot of films that performed well? So that's kind of an interesting look at it. And these re-releases, I don't know how they're going to skew those numbers even more.
Yeah, it feels like it was a movie a year of a bunch of like smaller numbers. We didn't have like a Dark Knight Rises or anything like that. And that's something I kind of wanted to talk about is Man of Steel. It's at 290 domestic, and you know, going into the summer, we were looking at the calendar and everything, and everyone like we saw everyone moving their release dates away from Man of Steel after Earth got moved up a week earlier, and God, I can't remember what else, and it left. The Internship and The Purge on the same date, and everyone expected The Intern. This was a week before Man of Steel came out, because everyone thought, you know, if we release it a week before Man of Steel, Man of Steel is going to take over the box office for the next month. And it really didn't. It had a huge drop in the second week. And I thought that was really interesting, because that was kind of marketed as, you know, the Dark Knight trilogy is over, but here's your next fix. Like, this is – Warner Brothers was banking on this to be that next thing. And it did make a lot of money, and they're moving forward with Batman versus Superman, but I think that – that is telling that they're bringing Batman into the fold instead of moving forward with another Superman sequel. I mean, 657 worldwide is nothing to scoff at, but do you guys feel like there's a weird perception issue with Man of Steel not being as big of a hit as people were expecting?
Well, Snyder had even gone back and said in an interview with Steve, I don't know when it was, but he basically, Steve asked him about like a Justice League movie and things like that. And Snyder said, you know, we got to get Superman back like squarely on his feet first, and that's kind of a non-answer. Like, what does that mean? So I don't know if it was always in a plan to have the Batman versus Superman thing, or if they were waiting to see how Man of Steel did. If it was a runaway hit, then to make a second one and then maybe bring Batman in to bridge towards Justice League. I have no idea what their actual plans were, but yeah, I'm assuming they expect it to be a somewhat bigger hit than it was. That being said, I would be okay with seeing this one in the theater again too. I mean, it was a mid-June release. I'd be okay with the re-release of that one, too, if they really wanted to pump up their numbers again. Because I enjoyed the first, like, two-thirds of it, and then that final act we all have had numerous discussions about. But again, I really enjoyed that movie, and I wouldn't mind seeing it again on the big screen. So that's one. I'm okay with where they're going, but I also enjoyed what they've already done. And I think most people do.
Yeah, with Man of Steel, I feel like it's so hard to measure success, because what we're seeing is only a fraction of the pie. It's like, oh, it only made $290 million domestic, and oh, it only made this much worldwide. But I don't know how much it brought in from toys and from tie-in promotions, and I don't know how much...
Product placement.
Yeah. Superman loves pancakes. And I don't know how well the DVD and the Blu-rays are going to sell. They're going to have that massive limited edition Blu-ray set. Like, I mean, massive in terms of how much is in it. I don't know how many editions there will be of it. But the point is that there are all these ancillary revenue streams where most movies make their money. That's the whole thing. There's the perception of a film's profit is incredibly flawed. So perhaps that the weak box office on Man of Steel means that the home video sales will be weak. We don't know. But I do know that as long as Man of Steel didn't utterly tank, it was enough for the next one. Man of Steel, to me, never even really... It felt like, yes, this is a new start for Superman, but I can't say the phrase a new start now without thinking of Arrested Development. I'm sorry for cracking up. But Man of Steel.
We'll get you a license plate.
Thank you.
Sure.
With Man of Steel, it felt like you want to be excited for that movie on its own terms, and I think we were. But from the business perspective, it's always like, but we got to put that Wayne Enterprises satellite in there, and we got to put that LexCorp building in there, and we have to keep doing everything to make sure that this world exists. We're already looking ahead in a way that feels very calculated, whereas if you go back to Iron Man, they even went on record, it's like, yes, we wanted to throw in the Nick Fury thing at the end in the hopes that it would happen. We didn't know. We had a plan, but we weren't like, yes. It was a fun thing at the end that could have grown into something bigger. Whereas opposed to Man of Steel, it's like, this is going to grow into something bigger.
It's forced.
This is going to happen. And honestly, I mean, while Man of Steel 2 would have probably been expected, I don't know, I guess... To say that Batman is in Man of Steel 2, that it's a Superman-Batman movie, it's perhaps unexpected, but not surprising, if that makes any sense. Because I would have expected Man of Steel 2 to be Superman and Lex Luthor. I did not expect Batman to be in there, but now he's in there, I'm like, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, it sounds like they're upping their timetable on what they want to get to. They want to get to the Justice League, I'm sure. But they also want to be, obviously, the first to bring... Batman and Superman together in a live-action feature for the first time, which I think that's a brilliant move. And, I mean, obviously from the way that people have reacted, not only to the casting, but first, like, the announcement of the fact that they were going to do that. I think they've had a crazy positive response to that, and it's a good move to do. It's a good way to sort of, I mean, Batman, as Christian Bale's Batman, hasn't been gone very long at all, and all of a sudden they're bringing a new one in within a couple of years. So a quick turnaround for some people, especially when you still have Nolan attached, even if he's not, you know, remotely as involved as he was before. It's interesting they're turning it around so fast, and they're just like, nope, we're just going to ride the Batman train. We're going to ride the Bat train as
well,
far as we can.
That's what Warner Brothers has now. Warner Brothers, right. its key properties is the DC universe. It needs that more than anything, and I've said this before, because Harry Potter is over. Gone. Before that, when you had Harry Potter, you could make a nice, you know, you could count on that money. That's gone now. And Warner Brothers, what do they have other than DC? Disney can be like, fuck, we'll give you 8 Lone Rangers a year because we got Marvel, Pixar, and Lucasfilm.
Yep.
What?
So like 6 or 7 years from now when Warner Brothers is like, we're rebooting the Harry Potter franchise. It'll be even more faithful to the books. It's like, really? So the first two are just going to be like someone sitting there reading the books? So that's the only way the first two films can be more faithful?
They're going to have Peeves in them now. Peeves the Poltergeist will now be in the movies.
They're going to have the Elf Liberation Society or whatever the hell it was.
Exactly. Spew. They'll have Spew. The movies, each of the movies will be 5 hours long.
I'm okay with that.
Something else I wanted to mention, too. I recently posted a feature on the site looking at 2015 because right now, currently there's a crazy amount of things scheduled for 2015. Whether most of them make it in 2015 or not, it remains to be seen. A lot of things change. But I was thinking back to I remember scrolling through the Box Office Mojo calendar back earlier this year thinking like, wow, this summer, like, there's so many good movies like Iron Man 3 and Fast and Furious 6 and Star Trek and Great Gatsby and all this stuff. So I wanted to ask you guys, what was kind of, you know, now that we've seen everything now in hindsight, what were maybe your most disappointing films and maybe pleasant surprises from this summer? Anything stand out?
Well, I want to say, looking back at every 3 months we write our most anticipated, because it's quarterly. Mm-hmm. And looking back, Star Trek Into Darkness was on the list, and Man of Steel was on the list, and they both had with reservations. Like, it was, even then, it wasn't like, oh, I'm so excited. And in terms of disappointments, Star Trek was easily a huge disappointment for me, because I am going to trust you. I have serious doubts about your skills as a writer. I have serious doubts about your investment as a director. I really hope the villain is... I was hoping to the last possible moment that it wasn't Khan. I was praying. Nope, it was. And then, even in the movie, I'm like, well, maybe they'll do something different. But no, they're not going to do something different. And it's just, it's such a bad movie, and it bothers me because I liked 2009's version. That's the whole thing. And so, to me, that was the biggest disappointment, because I also think it was the worst of the gigantic blockbusters. Like, yeah, Getaway is a worse movie, Mortal Instruments is a worse movie, but to me, that one did something truly abysmal. And
it hurts, because that first Star Trek is... I like that movie so much. I know a lot of people have problems with it, but... I like it too.
It's got
such rewatchability, and I was so excited for the.
Yeah.
I mean, we've waited so long. Abrams was so reserved. He was like, "I want to get the script right." He didn't sign on to direct until they finished the script, and it seemed like they were taking their time. But nope.
And now the worst part is like, now I just know not to be invested in Star. Like, it has ramifications. Like Man of Steel 2. Okay. Like I'll go with you on a second go-around. I'm still not that super eager to do it, but like Dave said, it's the first time Superman and Batman have ever been on the big screen together.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what you got. But as long as...
No one's not going to see that.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. No, no.
You don't need to market that at all. Just give them a release date.
There was
all
some guy at Dragon Con, probably the worst costume at Dragon Con I saw, some guy dressed as Robin holding a sign that says, God hates Ben Affleck. Like, it was like the Westboro Church kind of font. And I was just like, oh, come on, he works really hard. And just, like, it was just such that overreaction that you would probably see at a nerd convention. But people are going to go see it anyway, whereas I'm sure people could probably go see Star Trek in 3, but I'm not excited for it at all. To me, that franchise is dead until Abrams, Ortsey, and Kurtzman leave it. Until then, like, it's just like, here are three guys who don't know what they're talking about. And so... Star Trek Into Darkness really hit hard because it not only disappointed, but it brought dread to wherever else the series can go.
And not the Carl Urban style of dread, which I appreciated. But
and if that petition takes off, we're going to get a dread sequel. Yeah, right. But
yeah, I agree with you. It's Star Trek Into Darkness was my biggest disappointment because I did enjoy the first one. Like I said, I was looking for a good old-fashioned, hard, smart sci-fi movie that really got into like the core of sort of the Star Trek mythology. And instead, we got sort of this weird... I still don't even know exactly what to call it because I don't know what their mindset was when they were going into this movie. It was like they were going to take everything that fans loved about some of the iconic moments and films in the series and then just shit on it. And I don't know if they saw it that way. And
I don't think it was ever for the fans, to be honest. I think, and you look at interviews, it was more about, well, we're going to need to appeal to the mainstream and the fans can come along. Like, that was the whole thing. It was really more about having a moment like Spock screaming Khan.
See, but that makes even less sense because you're still using, you know, if you want to make mainstream, then make an original one with a mainstream formula. Fine, do that. That's fine. But then why bring in all these iconic moments and characters and lines of dialogue and completely fuck them and turn them around?
Oh, I completely.
And then say, well,
also,
I mean,
I completely agree. But it's like, to me, it's like, just as a reminder, you're watching Star Trek, except it's kind of like Star Wars. Continue. Yeah. Like, it's just that kind of thing where it's not, it's familiarity about it. And I agree. Do, if you're going to do some, just do a different story. It may not be the most original story ever, but again, just don't.
At least it's not copy and paste. And at least you don't have to bring in another character to explain how bad Khan is because you haven't taken the time to develop your villain. You're like, oh, how can we remind the audience that he's a bad guy? Let's bring in Leonard Nimoy and have him just say, oh, he's a bad guy. Trust me.
Yeah.
So, we originally agreed not to do this, but just this one time, because I'm real drunk right now.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were saying that about you, Dave, and you were like, we're not going to talk about Star Trek.
No, it's clearly
drunk podcasting. How unprofessional.
Oh, God, can we do that? Because I love drunk history, and I feel like drunk podcasting is just begging to be made.
We might have to. We should have done it for The World's End.
Done it for World's End.
Damn it!
Yeah.
That's a movie that I really hope finds an audience, and I kind of wish it had come out in like July or June on one of those slower weekends. I know there weren't many, but like open it. Well, I guess not opposite RIPD because that was Comic-Con, but that really doesn't make a big difference box office wise. But I felt like that should have gotten really, really like center stage attention. And you know, towards the end of August, people are getting ready to go back to school. Box office isn't as high.
Right. Although I think maybe with World's End, there might have been some consideration about the UK box office as well, like their release schedule is different.
Yeah, so, and Edgar and Simon and Nick really, really wanted to do a road tour. That's why the release dates are a month apart between UK and US, so that they could take a month in each country and take the film out.
Exactly. So, but I agree. Look, and I think it will. All of their movies have found an audience. Scott Pilgrim found an audience. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness for that. So I have no doubt that like a good film like that will find its way. Again, I'm more concerned about the ramifications of a film like Star Trek Into Darkness, which not only is technically a hit, you know, didn't make as much as the first one, but 228 is, you know, respectable. No one's calling it a flop. And it got that huge boost on Rotten Tomatoes, which I think is perhaps a result of over-eagerness. I don't know. I don't know how to justify, what is it, an 87% positive?
Devin has a theory that
people can become
bigger. Well, movies get a bigger pass towards the beginning of the summer, and then people get laid,
worn out.
Yeah, they get worn out from the summer glut, which I certainly felt. I think I've never been as taken with Captain America as everyone else, and I think it had something to do with there were so many superhero movies that year, and I was just done with it by the time it came out.
Have you gone back and rewatched it?
I have. It's still not my favorite, but okay. I mean, I can understand why people like it, but it's not my thing. But I mean, I was just like, after it, I was just like, no more superheroes. Like, I'm ready for the fall movie season. Like, I'm done with this.
Well, you never.
So I can understand it.
We've got another superhero on the year, so just count down.
2015
to it.
Is just gonna be. I mean, if those things stick, like, how are people gonna pay for this, and then how is it gonna pan out? Like, how do all these movies?
2015 feels like some bizarre experiment. Like someone in a laboratory saying, like, what if we brought all of these properties together, but we released them in the same year?
It's like
what would happen? It really is. It feels like a complete meltdown of what would happen. It's just you look at it, and it almost makes me a little upset because there's stuff in 2014 that I'm really looking forward to, and it's like, and all 2015 is already overshadowing an entire year. That's how big 2015 is.
So, I don't know what the hell is coming out next year. I'm, like, completely just sidetracked by everything in 2015. I have no clue what's coming out next year. I really should. I mean, we've still got some superhero
movies coming out.
We've got a new
Wachowski film
coming out.
I'm looking forward to that.
We have Lego, and we have X-Men Days of Future Past, and RoboCop, and,
Thank you for reminding me.
Captain America, Guardians of the Galaxy, Spider-Man. Right. Like, there's stuff, but we're just not focusing on it because it's like, yeah, you got two Marvel movies, but is either one of them named Avengers 2? No. Yeah. Never mind. Yeah.
Star Wars?
Really looking forward to Cap, though. Really looking forward to Cap. I'm curious to see how they handle that. I think there's going to be some interesting things that happen in that Cap sequel that's really going to impact where they're going with the rest of the movie. So that's definitely one to keep on the radar.
Right.
Doing some cool stuff there. The superhero movies this year, I mean, 2015 is interesting in that the spectrum of this year, in the lens of this year, because, like you guys mentioned, there were a bunch of things that we were looking forward to, the big blockbuster, big budget movies, but then there were a lot of little surprises that popped up throughout this summer, too. Now, 2015 is obviously going to be overshadowed by these juggernauts that are all these just superhero sequels. I have no clue what's going to pop up and sort of like grow up through the cracks in between. That's going to be interesting.
And that's what's exciting.
Yeah, it's fun to look forward to. We just don't know what they are yet.
Who'd have thought We're the Millers would be the comedy hit of the year? Like,
I did.
Did that well?
No. I liked it, though. Okay, you're talking about like good surprises. We're the Millers, and I know I'm in the minority on that one, but I also enjoyed Percy Jackson, which, again, I'm not gonna go, fuck you don't like Percy Jackson, but, like, as a guy who hated the first one, I'm like, oh, this is a nicer movie, okay. It's still
this
flopped.
Nice.
It's nice! It's a PG action-adventure movie. Where else was that in the summer?
Yeah, that's what you want. No, I gotta see both of them yet, but...
But
there's all those little... I mean, there's room for everybody. That's the thing. It's like these big hulking monstrosities that come through and just like crush box offices for a week or two. There's room for the little guy to kind of like sneak in there on off weekends or kind of through word of mouth, especially with VOD and everything now. There's opportunities for the little guys to kind of sneak in there and make some noise too. So it'll be an interesting one to look forward to after we get through 2014. That drag.
Stupid 2014 in the way of my Batman-Superman movie. Ugh, I hate it.
I will say one thing that I've been really disappointed with in the past few years is the lack of really good animated films, like How to Train Your Dragon, or...
In 2014, and that's one of my most anticipated of 2014, is How to Train Your Dragon.
2014's good. When the hell is... Where's our Wreck-It Ralph sequel, damn it? I haven't heard word one on that.
I know. I'm sorry, Adam. I interrupted you about animated films. I'm so excited for How to Train Your Dragon.
Well, as you should be. Yeah. But it just kind of feels like there's this vacuum. Like DreamWorks' output this year was awful. I mean, they had Turbo and
The Croods,
which actually did
well. Yeah, I can't even remember. There was Epic and
Epic is Blue Sky.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, like,
oh, in general.
Okay. I feel like we don't like
blame where blame is due, Adam.
Even the first Kung Fu Panda and, you know, Pixar. I mean, I liked Monsters University quite a bit, but I mean, we're already seeing they removed Bob Peterson from The Good Dinosaur, and Bob Peterson has been with that studio since the beginning. So I don't know what the hell's happening over there.
It's I know it's interesting. It's like now it's in the hands.
Planes.
Of
don't forget planes, guys. Come
fucking
on.
Planes.
Fucking planes.
Fucking planes. Oh, gosh. But
planes, fire, and rescue.
I mean, but no, you're right. I mean, I can't even... At least last year we had Paranorman, you know?
Yeah.
And so I don't even... And honestly, I don't know if we even... Do we even have any more animated stuff coming up this year?
I don't think
2013?
So.
I mean, that's a little...
I feel like DreamWorks always has something...
Yeah, like a November thing. But like Peabody and Sherman, like that's not...
That's been pushed back.
And I'm going to run through
like
it.
Like, Disney's Frozen is...
Oh, Frozen. It's Frozen. No,
like,
Frozen's in November. That's November. Disney's new thing now. Like, Wreck-It Ralph November. They have Disney's new thing about... Disney Animation Studios will now have a film in November.
Right.
That's their thing now. So, oh, and Free Birds. So
yeah,
there's
which
that.
Was originally turkeys, right?
Yes, and it's just really, if that movie's bad, it's just like... That softball down the middle for critics to just call it a turkey. Just there you go. Enjoy.
Just lay it out.
So yeah, I mean, those are pretty much the... Although, apparently, is Walking with Dinosaurs like a fan? Like, I saw a trailer for it, and I still don't even know what that is.
I don't know.
I think it's like an animated film.
Is it an anime? I thought that was the one that was like the live-action show that would go around to like different arenas and stuff. It was like these big, massive animatronic or puppet control.
It's based on that. It's a feature film based on that, but I don't know if it's animated or...
I saw the trailer, and I still don't know if it's like a science thing or if it's like as a story. Like, not that science can't have a story, but like if it would be more like a documentary thing. That I don't know. I don't know how that is. But that's... You're right, Adam. Like, animation is sort of... disheartening.
Well, we got the Nut Job 3D coming out next year, so you got that to look forward to.
Well, and it's just so disheartening because we've been talking about, I mean, Pixar used to be the gold standard, and we were right. Like, oh, like we have to sit through Cars 2, and you know, Brave wasn't all it's looked up to be, but then we were like, oh, they've got these really great original stories like The Good Dinosaur coming up and Lee Unkrich's Dia de los Muertos, and now the trouble with Good Dinosaur, 9 months till release, the director's been removed. The last time Pixar did that was Toy Story 2, but that was, you know, clearly earlier in the studio's career, they had much better track record.
How much time did Brad Bird have on Ratatouille?
I think he had about a year. I think he had a longer leak. I mean, he completely reworked that film.
Exactly. So here's the thing. I mean, this is not a new thing for Pixar. I mean, the newest thing about Good Dinosaur is that it would be Bob Peterson, someone who's been with them for so long.
Yeah,
but again, Pixar has a unique way of making movies, and that unique way has led to a lot of great films. So mm-hmm. It's a thing where when you have a decade of hits, you can almost sort of just be like, you take it, okay, I didn't like Cars 2, Brave was underwhelming, but
when three out of their last four films have directors removed during production, that isn't just like, oh, let's rework the story. It's like there are clashes and conflicts going on behind the scenes, and they are...
Yeah, but that's not how they spin it, though. They're spinning it in the way of, you know, sometimes this is that, like, their quote. Like, sometimes the director is so involved with the project that in order to finish it and get it to the point that we want it to be at, we need to get a second set of eyes, a second
which
vision
is so
in there.
Which is so anti-auteurist, though.
Like, and then they say it that they... Well, I 100% agree. And then they say that that should be... They actually think that that should be the case in a lot of live-action features, too.
See, I think Pixar...
That happens. Like, people lose their minds.
I don't think Pixar has ever actually been that... Like, I think Brad Bird, maybe. Like, but auteurist, like... Those films, like, go through everybody. Like, the storyboard, everyone looks... It's so collaborative in a way that the... Andrew Stanton didn't understand that he couldn't make John Carter like a Pixar movie.
Right.
That's why that film's budget just exploded, because he tried to make it like a Pixar movie, and it doesn't work that way. So to apply a live-action standard to an animation studio, I don't really think it works. Because, again, when we say Pixar movie, we say Pixar. We say the whole studio. We don't say John Lasseter. We don't say Lee Unkrich. I mean, they're directors, and we know them. And, Adam, I totally get what you're saying, where... You know, they haven't, you know, before they didn't really remove as many directors. But, I mean, even then they had co-directors. Co-directors are rare. You know, most films
sure,
don't
every
have
Pixar
them.
Movie has had co-directors. But, I mean, that...
Except Ratatouille and Incredibles, right?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. Inside Out looks pretty fantastic. The one that used to be titled the Untitled Pete Doctor picture that goes inside the mind, and it's now Inside Out. That actually looks really, really solid. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah,
and that kind of,
until they kick Pete Doctor off of it, and then who
yeah,
knows?
Yeah, that would be... But
well,
I don't think so.
About this before, about how Pixar is going through kind of the growing pains. I think this was last year during Brave. We talked about how we're seeing like their old school is kind of leaving the studio, and mm-hmm. it's bringing in this new school of filmmaking. But it just kind of feels like John Lasseter is taking control of everything himself, and his taste has not exactly been up to par as of late. He basically killed the 2D animation part of Disney, and now the director of Paper Man has left the studio. So
yeah, but let's be fair to John. I mean, it's not like he just like came in the door and like tried to kill it. In fact, he gave
it a lot of time.
The audiences didn't go for it. And I'm upset they didn't go for Princess and the Frog. They didn't go for Winnie mm-hmm. the Pooh. And that sucks. But I mean, again, he's a big supporter of Miyazaki, so I don't think that he was just like, fuck you, 2D boot. Like, that's Jeffrey Katzenberg. Jeffrey Katzenberg is like, I got burned by 2D so many times, I won't even look at a 2D movie anymore. Everything is 3D, and it's going to be in 3D. Like, that for them, there's no going back. But he's a corporate guy, and he appreciates animation, but John Lasseter is he's an animator. who also has business savvy to an extent.
And nice shirts.
And really colorful shirts.
Indeed.
So yeah, that just, and that's just one aspect. I mean, that's the whole thing. We're looking at these summers and it's like, it's this and it's that, but you know, you break it down. It's like, no, it's superhero movies. It's animation movies. And, you know, to just sort of label, it's like good, you know, you want to take a stand and say good, bad, and just move on with it. But again, you just, you break it all down. Oh shit, we forgot an animated film that I, one of my, boy, this doesn't bode, speak well for how much I'm looking forward to it. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2. Animated. Yep. Can't wait.
Well, that's next year though, right?
That's in September.
Oh, it's September. Oh.
Exactly. So, oh. I'll just chalk it up to trying to ease out of summer 2013.
But, no, that'll be a good one too. I'm looking forward to that. Right, I gotta watch the original one again sometime soon.
God, the original is just, I really do think it's like one of the best films of the last 5 years. I just, it blows, or at the very least, one of the funniest films of the last 5 years. It just destroys me every time with how good it is. But, and I, with summer 2013, I would say on the whole, there wasn't anything, everything that really got me going were indie films, and it's a little weird for me to say that because most of the indie films I saw at festivals, so I didn't even see these films in the summer. I come to summer 2013 as someone who's saying, go see these films I saw in the spring. So it's a little weird, but again, there was good stuff. I don't want to indulge in hyperbole, and we're going to keep doing this. The studios have no plans on changing what they're doing. No. 2015 tells us it's only getting bigger. And this year's box office tells us that audiences are still showing up. They may be showing up for fewer films, but the money that's getting spent is still the same.
I think go ahead, Adam.
Well, I was just going to say, Guillermo del Toro was handed $200 million, and we got to see that movie get a giant push and a big summer release. So I think that's something that was really exciting about this summer, too.
Yeah, I wish it would have got embraced a little more on the domestic front, but the fact that it's doing well internationally, I'm fine with that too. That's fine. I'll be buying that Blu-ray, not so much the Star Trek Into Darkness, but yeah, I think my biggest disappointment, just overall and sort of a general theme of disappointment with summer 2013, was just movies that didn't finish. You know, movies that had a solid first two acts, and then that third act just devolved into sort of this mess of I don't even know what, but it's interesting to see, like, there were a number of high profile movies that kind of did that. They were solid for the first 66%, and then they just did not finish in a way that was satisfying to me. Like Wolverine is one that was like that. Man of Steel is another one we've talked about quite a bit. That I think was the biggest disappointment for me, was just not getting, there were a lot of entertaining movies. There were a lot of movies that I'd like to see again, but the movies that were complete and felt fully realized and fully finished were few and far between. I don't know if you guys kind of feel the same or if you were happy with more than I was.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. I kind of felt like there was there were a lot of movies that kind of started, like you said, good, but then there were a few other movies of the summer that I just hated, like Kick-Ass 2. I could not stand that movie.
That was pretty bad.
And I was really surprised. But then other movies that I surprised that I liked quite a bit, like The Great Gatsby, I thought that was really well done. I really enjoyed that. So
yeah, I third act wise, I feel like a lot of movies have third act problems, no matter when they come out.
Yeah, they do. But then they're so. I think so many of them were so disjointed this year, though. It was almost like they were, I've said it before, that they were kind of schizophrenic. Like the first two acts, if you set up like this heroic samurai journey, lone warrior for the first two acts, and then just jump into the pages of a comic book for the last act, that's fine, but at least have some sort of string of like consistency and coherence to tie it all together. If you spend the first two-thirds of a movie talking about a superhero trying to find his place in a human world, then maybe, and care for the humans that are in his life, then maybe don't kill them all in the last act. I don't know. It's just nothing ever was like completely tied together in like a really solid movie start to finish for me.
On the flip side, I would say the third act of World War Z is much better than the first two acts.
I haven't seen it.
I was very pleasantly surprised by that.
Okay.
And what did that do differently? It took it small instead of big. Like
exactly. Yeah. I'm so tired of the city destruction third act climactic battle, which is why I'm excited to see what Joss Whedon does with the Avengers 2, because he's not a fan of repeating himself. And, you know, I want to see what a Joss Whedon sequel looks like, a sequel movie. Like, how does he, Because I think he's someone that understands the pitfalls of sequels and understands that going bigger does not necessarily mean mean better. But when you have a team of like the most famous superheroes in the world, what do you do? So I'm really excited for that.
See, and that's interesting too. That's why I at least gave a pass to the Avengers city destroying third act, because they had moments in there that focused on each character, not only like protecting citizens, but protecting each other and taking care of each other. And there was actual dialogue rather than just punches and smash 'em ups and explosions. You know, there was some tension building. Arguably, it's the weakest part of that film, just kind of like the smash 'em up sequence. But I still think that gets a pass on some of the ones we've seen this year, just because of those details. And the devil really is in the details in films like that. You can have that big climactic ending as long as you do it in a way that Whedon did, or do it in a way that consistently ties in the rest of the plot and the thematic elements you've been building up for the rest of the movie. You know, if you're going to talk about teamwork, then you better show it in that last act.
Like having a giant Satan with a swinging dick destroying the world.
That's a hell of a theme, man.
And with that, let's go to recommendations. Dave, what do you got for us?
I'm going to go with Your Next, only because that just came out about a week ago. And like we said, that kind of was the end of the summer season. Everybody's going back to school. Maybe you missed this one. But it's getting good reviews, has good word of mouth. It's a tough sell because you can't talk about it too much because you ruin what actually makes it kind of special. But it starts out as sort of a family gathering get together, and then it turns into a home invasion flick that is drastically different from all the other home invasion flicks you've probably ever seen. So it's a little bit of a thriller. It's a little bit of a horror show, and it's actually got a touch of the comedy in there too. There's a lot of really fun moments that this movie is one of the best to see with an audience. The audience and crowd reactions are great. If you've got a good, solid audience, and a lot of people actually, I rarely want to go see movies with a lot of people, but if you have a good crowd, this one's a lot more fun. I'm not going to say too much more than that, other than go check it out, maybe watch a trailer or two, because they're pretty good with not spoiling things. So You're Next should still be playing in theaters now.
Okay, Adam?
We talked quite a bit about the summer movie season, but we kind of kept it to the blockbusters, but this year had a lot of indies that were really great. As Matt said, Francis Ha, Spectacular Now, Before Midnight, all worth a look. But I am going to be recommending Woody Allen's latest Blue Jasmine, which just recently expanded nationwide into, I think, Woody Allen's widest release ever. And, you know, Allen makes a film every year, so it's kind of hit and miss, so you're not really sure what you're going to get. But Blue Jasmine is one of his top tiers. It's really, really great. Cate Blanchett plays the titular Jasmine, and she's a former New York socialite who loses all of her money and moves to San Francisco in order to start life anew. She moves in with her sister, played by Sally Hawkins, and it's kind of this culture clash between, you know, Blanchett's Jasmine character has been used to this New York lifestyle, and she's kind of around the blue collar people. You've got Andrew Dice Clay, who is great in the film, surprisingly, as Sally Hawkins' ex-husband, Louis C.K., Bobby Cannavale, and they all kind of, you know, come together and create this really great ensemble. But Cate Blanchett is phenomenal in this movie. It is, I mean, I heard the word tour de force thrown around before the movie, and, you know, that's kind of one of those things that people say and you don't really believe it. But I mean, I haven't seen a performance good in I don't know how long. It's she just disappears in this role, and it's one of Woody's darker films. It really kind of goes to some dark places. This is not Midnight in Paris. Alec Baldwin plays her husband, and Peter Sarsgaard is also in the movie. But it's really, really worth a look if you can catch it. I promise it's well worth your time, and you'll just be captivated by Blanchett's performance. It literally sucks you in. You can't stop watching. So definitely seek out Blue Jasmine.
Adam is literally speaking from inside that movie as we speak. Literally got sucked in. Sorry.
I didn't know what you were saying.
I'm just being an ass. Don't mind me.
Those are both great choices. Your Next and Blue Jasmine are excellent. Well, first off, my favorite film of the year thus far, and it came out this summer, is The Act of Killing, but I've already recommended it. So I'm going to recommend another one of the best films I've seen this year, which just came out in limited release, Short Term 12, and it's starting to expand. I saw this at South by Southwest, and originally I was just like, I saw that it had Brie Larson in it, who I like. She's been in Scott Pilgrim, United States of Terror, Spectacular Now, bunch of supporting roles. But I read the description, it's like, and it just sounded so corny. It's like, you know, so-and-so helps a bunch of at-risk kids in a thing, and she finds hope. And it was just one of those terrible, it's like, oh, this is going to be the most, you know, saccharine piece of garbage. And then, of course, naturally, word at South by Southwest starts exploding about how this is an amazing movie and everyone has to go see it. And it turned out to be. The plot, Brie Larson plays a young woman named Grace who works at a at-risk facility for young kids called Short Term 12. And she works alongside her boyfriend, who's played by the Newsroom's John Gallagher Jr. And Grace has her own sort of abuse in her past. All of these kids, their parents probably abuse them in some way, or this isn't quite, it's not foster care, it's more of a protective thing, and they have rules in place, and these are kids that can lash out, but also need some care. It's a fascinating environment that we haven't really seen before on screen. And eventually Grace meets this one young girl who's trauma she can really relate to, and that starts bringing out Grace's own personal demons that she's been hiding from. And the performances are just astounding. It can be absolutely heartbreaking, but it never feels manipulative. It earns every moment of emotion that it has. And my feeling about it is that I really hope people see it, because it's going to be one of those films that it would be so great in the awards race, but instead it just ends up highlighting how only studios with a large budget can really get in the awards race. And Short Term 12 came out of South By. It's playing in the middle of a summer, and people are already bored. But it is expanding, and I just want you to keep the title in your mind, Short Term 12. And maybe you'll see it in theaters, maybe you'll spot it on DVD, but I just hope that you find it. So Short Term 12 is my recommendation. We won't be doing a show next week. Adam and I will be at the Toronto International Film Festival seeing movies that are probably better than what we saw this summer. At least it's a new take. It's not even that. We're going to turn the page and we're going to see some stuff. And I'm already seeing the buzz out of Venice and Telluride and getting excited. Mm-hmm. And so that'll be a lot of fun. But then, you know, depending on how tired we are, just to be completely honest with our audience, I get back on the 15th. And I could be completely exhausted and not podcast ready. But we will be back. We'll be in September. We're going to be talking more award stuff. It's going to be a whole new part of the year. So if you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw MD.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll be back with you in a few weeks.